probably know what your favorite meal is, but do you know where its ingredients came from? If you're like me, then taste has been the main selling point of food for most of your life. But that is changing. In Western Wisconsin, there is a growing number of restaurants going local with their ingredients and going seasonal with their menu planning. It's a wonderful movement, and this hour we'll discuss how it started, how difficult it is for restaurateurs to incorporate more local food into their offerings, and most importantly, how available it is to all consumers. This is The West Side. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning on Ideas 88.3 WHWC and 88.7 WRFW River Falls. Joining me in studio, I have got an all-star publisher and two all-star chefs. First, Arwin Rasmussen, publisher of the Farm Fresh Atlas and about 10 other magazines. And Second Opinion, of course, is probably one of the more well-known ones. But welcome to the program, Arwin Rasmussen.
Thank you, Rich.
Also joining me, Amy Ho is the executive chef at the Informalist in the Lismore Hotel downtown Eau Claire. Amy Ho, welcome.
Hey, how's everybody doing today?
Doing very good. They can't respond. They have to call in first.
But I'm asking you guys.
Oh, well, we're doing all right. You guys doing all right?
Pretty good.
I'm looking forward to this conversation because it's laid back. Normally we're talking about politics and real heavy stuff, so hopefully we'll have some fun today. Last but not least, Nathan Berg is the head chef at the Lakely at the Oxbow Hotel near downtown Eau Claire. It's still downtown.
Yeah, it's downtown.
Welcome to the program, Nathan.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Thank you very much for being here. Also, a little bit later, we're going to hear from Matthew Giguere. He is a professor at the UW-Stout School of Hospitality Leadership, and he'll talk about some of the exciting things they're doing with students preparing the next generation of restaurateurs and restaurant managers to be thinking about local ingredients. So I always start these things with the big, generic, overarching question. So I'll go round robin. I can't find a single definition for what local food is. So Arwin Rasmussen, you tell me what local food means to you.
Well, local food obviously is within an area where you can meet the farmer, where you can pick it up fresh, pick daily, pick weekly. It can be delivered to you in a box. Mm-hmm. And you can connect with the community that grows what you eat. That's local.
All right. We'll get into some of the manifestations because we certainly have a lot of options here in the Chippewa Valley. Nathan Berg, your take on local food. Is local food and farm-to-table the same thing?
Yeah, essentially it is. It's to me, as a chef, local food means food that comes from our region. Doesn't have to travel too far to get there. And as a chef, that means that it's always the freshest sort of food, so often the best tasting. But yes, it also means that you get to meet the people who produce it and, you know, befriend them. And so it extends just into the overall idea of a community. So it means that your food is coming as part of your community, not from outside of it.
And Amy, well, is there a definite, as far as mileage, I mean, local food, I keep seeing a lot of restaurants talk about within 100 miles radius or something. Is it as simple as that, or is it as complicated as that?
I think it's actually pretty complicated sometimes, and I only say that because many of the people we work with gather a lot of their things from other places, and they bring them to us. Mm-hmm. So that actually makes it more sustainable, right? So you don't have many different vehicles gathering many things. You just have one. Like Dragsmith, for example, we both work with them.
What's that again?
Dragsmith in Barron. They're one of our farms that we work with.
Okay.
they grow a lot of stuff themselves, but they also gather a lot of the local meat that's in the Barron area, and then they will bring us a lot of things from other farms near them.
Okay.
So it's more about understanding that you're not going to waste resources gathering those things from farms because they all separately have to bring you their stuff by themselves. It's understanding that you are, you know, saving the environment sort of by like using the most sustainable way of getting the plants and getting the meats and all that stuff.
So really there's some, sounds like there's a lot of thought that goes into this conscientiousness kind of a situation. Listeners, I want to hear from you what you think local food is, and what are your thoughts about what seems to be, at least to me, in my layman's from my layman's perspective, more restaurants or more attention being paid to local ingredients. Give us a call at 1-800-228-5615. We'd love to hear from our listeners. Have you been to any of these restaurants? You can give a review live on the air.
Oh, great.
seriously, it's a big topic, and it's exciting, I think, for a lot of people to see more people putting a lot of care and craft into their food in general. It's kind of, to me, like the new old-fashioned way, but I'll get into that in just a bit. 1-800-228-5615. You can also post on the Westside Facebook page. Is it new to Western Wisconsin, this idea of using local ingredients? Amy Hull.
I don't think it's new. I don't think that everyone is used to us using the terms farm to table.
Sure.
I think that that's kind of a new thing. I'm not sure if anyone's really had to reconsider where all of their ingredients are coming from around here. I mean, my parents grew up growing all of their own stuff, so they didn't have to really think about it that hard. If they went out to eat, they didn't ask where the things were coming from because they went out to eat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think our culture has shifted a lot, and that's part of the reason that we're doing what we're doing is because there are many large food distribution chains happening now that are not great for our environment, and
sure,
we have tried to shift the focus back to those smaller farms and supporting people who are doing better things with their food.
I think of, and I don't want to point any fingers here, but you've got some large supply chains like the Sysco's, and there's others I know. Up in the Twin Ports where I'm from, there was the Great Lakes Food, whatever. But these companies that you get a box that's from the West Coast or wherever, and it's been packed in ice. And earlier you mentioned, Nathan, that the ingredients are fresher, they taste better. Is it something that most people, without all the branding, you know, the saying that this is local, this is where it came from, would people actually be able to taste test a difference between, I don't know, a stalk of celery from locally grown or from a distributor like that?
Yeah, I definitely think that they could. And it's more than just the fact that it's fresh. A part of it is that because industrialization has happened with food, the industrialists have had to spend years trying to pick out the exact varieties that work best for them to be able to sit as long as possible in
right.
in a cooler, in a refrigerated truck, in a warehouse somewhere. And they also want them to look really beautiful. You know, they get to the, you know, what I've always said, they have the cardboard equivalent of a tomato these days because they can be bright red and beautiful, and then
yeah.
you cut into them and they're almost transparent and pretty devoid of flavor. Whereas you get a local fresh heirloom tomato from a farmer, they can grow varieties that these companies can't ship all over the place and just don't work for their systems. And then it might be uglier by somebody's standard of
yeah.
the word. It might have some, it might have some scars going down the side and not be perfectly round. And it can be orange or white or blue or whatever. There's every color of the rainbow for a tomato, but you bite into it and it's just an absolutely 100% different experience.
And Arwin Rasmussen, so who decides what is, you know, because you've got these ideas from the shelf life perspective where this is what a tomato is supposed to look like. But yet, like he says, the heirlooms, they often look bumpy and stuff that, because I worked in a grocery store, stuff that we would chuck.
Right.
We would throw out. So
it didn't look perfect. That's why you threw it out.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Or it had one little spot
sure.
or you know, one of those
mm-hmm.
stripes up along the side. So who is the arbiter of what is and what isn't a beautiful, this is way off topic, but like, do you think that it's changing? So instead of the distributors deciding what is good,
mm-hmm.
is it more the consumer? Is it chefs?
I think so.
What
I think it's definitely consumer driven, because the more farmers markets you have, the more people are able to explore those different varieties you don't see.
Right.
So then they see it at the farmers market, they pick it up because it looks funky and cool and they want to see what they can do with it, and then they realize how much better it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then perhaps they see the farm to table on the restaurant logo or something like that, and they're like, maybe we'll try that. And then, of course, Nathan and Amy are using that kind of stuff, and that just drives the whole movement, is that I had a great experience, I had great food, you know, and then they come and they see that the carrots still have the tops on them, you know, when they come out roasted, and you know, most people throw that away. And it's just, it's just changing that. It doesn't have to look like the pictures on the TV commercials. And in fact, if it doesn't, it's almost better because you know that it's fresher and prepared better and grown in a way that that you can enjoy it in all kinds of levels.
We're into the theoretical and the big picture stuff, but we're going to dive down here in just a bit. But first, we got a call from Fall Creek. Jacob is on the line. Jacob, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
What's on your mind?
How are you doing today?
We're doing all right. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good.
What do you got for us?
So, first of all, I'd like to say I have not eaten at any of your restaurants, so I won't give you guys a review right now. I would like to, definitely. But I'm just, you know, I've grown up in the area my entire life, and I think that local foods, you know, they seem so much better. They probably taste much like they normally would if you get them, got them from other areas, but it's the perception of having the fresh food from, say, just down the road that makes it that much better. It makes it that much worthwhile to go out and try these foods that that people are suggesting you to eat because, you know, it's grown in the area, and it brings the community together as a whole, I think.
All right. A great point. Thanks for that, Jacob. We had some mixed reactions to the comment. First of all, I want to get to the marketing side of things. Like, is the whole movement, is the local food thing, is it really just mental trickery? Or people are I'm going to go to you, Amy Hall, because you kind of...
I have a lot to say about that, but I thought the question was going to go a little bit differently.
Sure.
So I'm going to talk about what I think is really important to understand. We live in a place, you know, that you can only grow things so long during the year, and we have varieties of vegetables and breeds, heirloom breeds of meat that only grow here, and they have a flavor that is unique because they only grow here. And I think it's really important to understand that getting produce from far away means that stuff was grown in a different place where you're not actually living, and that means it tastes different.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the pesticides, aside from the herbicides, aside from all the things that they have to do to amend the soil to grow mass quantities of things, that produce is going to taste different than the stuff that you buy down the street. So,
but is that in and of itself a problem?
You know what? I don't know if it's a problem. But I think that if we, like Nate and I, are going to really promote what we're proud of, which is what this area produces, I think it's something that we really have to support and work with and celebrate, like, just the flavor of the things that come from this area. I mean, it's the same as if you get wines from different regions. They have a terroir. It's exactly the same here with vegetables and meats that are grown here. We want to celebrate that stuff, because we are proud of what we have in this area.
Nathan Berg, and then I'll go to Arwen Rasmussen, but the idea of the local food, selecting local ingredients as a way to bring community together, do you agree with what Jacob was saying?
I very much agree with that, and I've often found that, to me, that was maybe the element. When you talk about this philosophical stuff, obviously, like, folks like us have spent lots of time reading and listening to speakers and all that kind of thing. And I think until I really got involved in it, the part that was missing for me, or that I wasn't expecting, was this connection to the community. I've been working with local farmers here in the Chippewa Valley area since 2005. And I've gotten to know their children. I know their pets. I know their land. I've watched some of their kids graduate from high school and then college. And there's an element to that that's just, you know, great in and of itself for community purposes. But I also found that as a chef, it helps you incredibly when you have a connection to these people, because you don't want to even try to do anything mediocre with their food when you understand how much hard work and effort goes into it, and you understand, you know, how they're making their livings and everything. And it makes you just think, like, you know, when you see just a regular carrot from a farm or something, you don't just see a carrot. You see all that stuff behind it. And it really you really start to think of it as special as it truly is, and you cook it appropriately.
That's an interesting point.
You also don't waste anything. We don't waste anything. Nothing gets thrown away. Everything is either dehydrated or frozen or used in another way. And, like, I'm sure that you guys do that too, because you don't want any of that hard work to go to waste. You know exactly how hard it is to produce all that stuff.
That's interesting. Do you guys think very quickly that there's a perception that people that are growing the local foods, you know, that maybe they've got it easier than someone who's got a massive, huge farm? You know what I mean? Because I think there might be an impression that that's just a hobby farm. You know, they're a CSA, so they're not working to the same extent. Misconception?
Definitely a misconception. I'm sure a lot of people work harder on a farm like that. And also, the smaller the farm, the more you have to diversify. So, you know, a lot of these vegetables that we get, if we're going to stay on the subject of a carrot, I suppose, then in California, you'll have a farm where that's all it is 200 acres of the exact same uniform variety of carrot. Mm-hmm. And it's all, you know, every single one of them gets treated the same way. It's basically more like the factory approach to farming, whereas you get a farm around here in the area and, you know, one, you could grow three different varieties of carrots, but some kind of pest could take out one, or inclement weather could take out another, and you can't rely just on carrots on your farm. You have to grow a bunch of different things, if not also raise meat or have dairy cows or something to that effect. And so so I find that the small local farms have to be more diverse, and that often means having to do a lot more things.
Arwin Rasmussen, you put together the Farm Fresh Atlas, which is kind of a guide for people to find these local producers. I wanted to ask you about the whole idea of the community surrounding the local production of food. Eau Claire, in the last 5 years, has seen tremendous growth in terms of, you know, we've got new hotels, we've got these new restaurants, there's this excitement building. What kind of a role does food play in that, in building the identity of the city of Eau Claire, for example?
The area? I think it has a lot to do, first of all, of who's helping grow the community. Mm-hmm. So what their mindset is. If they're connected to local anything, local beer, local food, local, just the downtown local, they're going to build there, right? If they're connected to the food, they're going to hire someone like Amy or Nate that also thinks the way they do. So I think a city can grow, you know, exponentially over 5 years and not care at all, you know, what that looks like. But Eau Claire certainly turned a corner when it's come to, you know, the informalist opening and what they thought and what, you know, Zach thought when he decided he was going to have a restaurant in his hotel. You know, it's going to be like this. What Nick Meyer and all of the Justin Vernon and all the investors of the Oxbow thought when they're going to have, you know, the Lakely open, and who's going to be behind the kitchen and all that. So I think it has everything to do with, you know, cities are growing all the time. But it's the mindset that we're going to keep it local. It's going to be downtown. It's going to be accessible. We're going to connect the community together as one.
And, of course, we're mentioning Eau Claire a lot because there is some exciting stuff happening in the city. But this movement, this idea is by no means specific to Eau Claire or even larger cities. We see some restaurants in Amory, Menominee. So give us a call and let us know if you've got restaurants or growers or whatever in your region. Tell us how the local food movement is hitting where you live. 1-800-228-5615. We're getting some great calls coming in. We've got lots more room for more callers. 800-228-5615. We'll take our first break. It'll be a short one. We'll be back with more discussion about farm to table, local food, delicious produce from our region, delicious meats. I can't wait to talk about the nuts and bolts of how to run a kitchen using these types of ingredients. With our restaurateurs and what goes into publishing this massive, massive fresh food guide. This is the West Side. I'll be back with Nathan Berg of the Lakely Restaurant in the Oxbow Hotel, Amy Hoesig of the Informalist, at the Lismore, and Arwen Rasmussen, publisher of the Farm Fresh Atlas and Second Opinion, and many more. Also, in just a bit, we're going to hear from Matthew Giguere. He's a professor at UW-Stout's School of Hospitality Leadership. If you've got a question or comment, join in the discussion. It always makes it better. This is the West Side.
Support for WPR comes from the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin Foster Care Program, dedicated to helping thousands of Wisconsin foster kids connect with caring families. More about being a foster parent is at chw.org/TFC. Support also comes from UW-Eau Claire Continuing Education, offering a master's in professional development through education studies. One Saturday a month, the rest is online. Details at 715-836-4021.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this beautiful Monday morning. We're talking about local food and its impact on the community and its impact on our bellies, I guess. Better quality, local sourced. A lot of the proponents say it's better for the environment. Good all around. There's a lot of questions to unpack here, but I want to get into the nuts and bolts of how these folks that run these restaurants incorporate it and how much of a challenge it is to use local farmers and to search them out rather than just ordering a case of carrots from Sysco or whatever company. I've said that twice now, the company's name, so I'll stop doing that. But if you've got a question or a comment, give us a call at 1-800-228-5615. We'd love to hear from you. And we're going to be bringing on Matthew Giguere, professor at UW-Stout's School of Hospitality Leadership, in just one bit. But first, let me start with Nathan Berg at the Lakely. Just in general, I want to ask the chefs here, and first of all, am I supposed to be referring to you as Chef Berg and Chef Huo?
He hates that, but yeah. I love it.
You love it? All right. Chef Huo
and Nathan.
And Nathan, okay.
Thank you.
How much...
Poor Nate.
I would assume that it is more work to use locally sourced ingredients. Is it, and how so?
No, Amy, I think you'd agree that we just relax a lot, right?
Yeah.
We definitely don't spend much time in the kitchen. It's not a big deal.
No. Yes, it's definitely a lot more work. I mean, first and foremost, it's, and this is maybe more specific to our style of restaurants, but
sure.
But you know, everything's made from scratch because we're ordering all the raw ingredients. It doesn't have to be that way to use local foods. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you could still just order potatoes from them and do something, you know, simple from a potato or whatever. But generally speaking, these aren't processed items, and so we're building everything from scratch. That in and of itself is a challenge within the restaurant business. You're not just having things come in, opening up bags and boxes and heating things or whatever. You have to spend the money on the labor for people to actually, you know, sit and do all these small tasks, peeling things and chopping things and whatever else. I mean, it's very, very time consuming. And so you pay a higher cost in labor. And that's, you know, above and beyond the fact that sometimes because they don't have the large distribution system, then you're paying more for the food as well.
Sure.
So, you know, it ends up being a little pricier in that regard too. But then on top of that, the amount of time and logistics that you spend putting in the orders for all these items, finding out exactly what farms have what they had crop failure on here, and then changing around our menus and developing new dishes and all that kind of stuff, because you have to, if you're going to commit as to the level that Amy and I have in our kitchens to that amount of local food, you have to be seasonal. You have to be ready to change your menu at a heartbeat because you're not always going to be able to get all of the things that you want. And in fact, that's the difference with this style of cooking, is that you find what you have and then you create your dishes. You don't decide what dish you want
bingo.
And then go out and find the ingredients.
Bingo. Expand on the bingo.
Okay,
Amy
so,
Hall.
I mean, this is a thing that we have talked about a lot, but many restaurants, chain restaurants and whatever, they sort of have an approach that's like, I have this menu and now I have to find all these things to fit it.
Sure.
But I think Nate and I usually do it the opposite way. I mean, I have a cooler full of things. I have a freezer full of things, whatever the farmers say. You know, a lot of them show up at the back door and say, I have 10 pounds of spinach. Do you want it? Can you do something with it? And you have to make something out of that. That's where the skill is involved, is that we have to make a menu out of what we can get, not decide that there's going to be a steak dish and then try to find all the things to fit that.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
It's sort of an opposite way that other restaurants usually create their menus. So, you know, we don't do the chicken Alfredo over pasta. We don't do that kind of stuff because it's not something that we can source locally and it's not something we can have all the time. So we have to be more creative.
So how often do you change the menus? Because I would assume that, some people would be kind of thrown by that. I mean, and that gets into another question that we're going to get into in just a bit of whether or not the patrons to your restaurants, that they're changing, their expectations about food and everything are changing. I would imagine they are, but... So if you can get 10 pounds of spinach, how long does that last in a restaurant that serves, I don't know, how many people a day?
It depends on a lot of things, but it also depends on your ability to utilize the product. So there's many things you can do with every kind of product. Like I said before, I don't throw anything away. So my staff has a joke. They all joke with each other. They're like, don't throw that away unless you ask Amy already, because I usually get super mad if they throw anything away.
Sure.
I mean, you can do a lot of different things with a small amount. Like we have ramps, right? So
yeah.
I put some of them in our smoker. I froze some. I dehydrated some. I pureed them. I put them in some of our bakery items. I mean, you have to – I pickled a bunch of them. We have –
Is that with specific things in mind, or is that just because you need to do something with these ramps?
To be completely honest, I have zero ideas in mind when I do all this stuff.
Sure.
I am not joking. I usually gather as much as I can get that's in season, and I fill up every space that I can find to fit it in. And then somewhere down the road, maybe in July, I'll be like a pickled ramp something or other, and then... That's what I do. So I have to, for me personally, my creative process works that way, is that I have to look at everything that I have already and create something out of it.
Now, when it comes to, we've been talking about produce, but when it comes to meat, I mean, you can't, if I imagine, is it more expensive to get a local cow? And how does that work? Because I know that if you're getting beef, for example, I know that from in a restaurant, I worked at a chain restaurant which shall remain nameless, but everything came in plastic bags. Every steak, you open up the plastic bag, you throw it on, it's already seasoned. Blammo, it can be out in 10 minutes. You guys might not have that luxury. Do you get steaks in a bag, Nathan Berg? And if not, I mean, how much extra work goes into, you know, processing the meat?
I think we've just distilled this entire conversation down. How appealing does steak in a bag sound? We don't. It's more expensive. The scale of operation for these smaller farms just alone is what makes it cost more. But again, they're also maybe raising breeds that aren't just alive to create as much meat as possible.
Heirloom breeds, or what are they called?
A heritage breeds
heritage,
is what they're often
me.
Referred
yeah,
to.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the same thing as what an heirloom is for a piece of produce. But yeah, so they'll grow more unusual breeds, sometimes that have a lot more flavor, but sometimes maybe not as tender or not what people are used to, you know, since I'd say the, you know, late 1940s as we ramped up the industrialization of agriculture, things have gotten very one-dimensional. So a steak is thought of as only one thing, whereas, you know, it can – even the same cut from ten different animals can taste 10 different ways, you know.
Sure.
So, but yeah, so it's it is more expensive. It's more of a challenge, but it is more appealing if you're like me and steak in a bag sounds –
yeah.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Julia Childs had a cookbook called The Joy of Cooking, and working at this place, it was the antithesis of that.
Right.
But so, Arwin Rasmussen, you, with this Farm Fresh Atlas, first of all, how do you find, because Nathan and Chef Huo talked about the work that goes into trying to find the suppliers.
Right.
You've got a whole... magazine, a whole mess, to use the technical term. But how do you find them, and how much work goes into building your Farm Fresh Atlas, which comes out annually?
Oh, it's a lot of work. It's every time you turn around, there's another farm somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's either.
Do they reach out to you or are you?
A lot of them do. A lot of them have been in this publication since its inception in 2006.
Okay.
But there again, when I took over, I wanted to find all of them because that's the kind of person I am. Let's be inclusive. I'm kind of a perfectionist that way. So you could work on this all year long. You could find new farms. You could connect with them. The challenge in Wisconsin is that in order to have an atlas that leads you to the most local food options, it needs to be out at a certain time period. So you can't work on it all year long, but right. We try to. But there are farms, you know, I mean, in every nook and cranny of Wisconsin that are just producing, you know, this heritage something or this heirloom something, or their CSA that's just starting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a lot time consuming, but it's very rewarding when you connect with those people and they see that you have this resource, that people can find them more easily, and then they're excited to be a part of it. And it just kind of everything comes together because they know they're going to benefit from it. And people who aren't looking for local food or aren't into that can maybe pick it up and try to start looking, mm-hmm. start changing the way they think about the steak in a bag versus, you know.
Yeah, so that kind of leads me to the why. I mean, why do you do this? This obviously is some kind of obsession you've got.
It is. I don't know. When I started Second Opinion, that was when my obsession started. So I've only had the Farm Fresh Atlas for a couple of years. But when it came, you know, up for grabs, I took it in a minute because that's what – the best food I've ever had started at this guy's restaurant, actually, when he owned Native Bay. Mm-hmm. You know, we connected way back in 2005, and my husband and I went out there, and it was like, my husband still talks about the best dinner was something Nathan made. Mm-hmm. And no one's ever been able to really top it. And I can't remember what it was right now. But if he calls in, he could tell you. But that's kind of where it started. It's like, we need to connect these people. And so Second Opinion started with, you know, alternative health, but a lot of that is, you know, the pesticide-free, the chemical-free, the local people that are bringing it to the farmer's market and all that, and they just kind of exploded. So it's a passion of mine. I believe that everyone should eat local. You shouldn't eat it, you know, the chain restaurants. You should experience your food. You should understand what goes into it and what the chefs have to do in order to bring it to you. It's not, again, like Amy said, you don't just order steak and potatoes because that's what's on the menu. You branch out. You have an experience with the meal, mm-hmm. not just, you know, filling your gut.
Yeah, different relationship with food, definitely. And it seems like more people are embracing that. I'm going to bring in Matthew Giguere. He is a professor at the UW-Stout School of Hospitality Leadership. He joins us on by phone. Matthew, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us on the discussion. Tell us about how students at UW-Stout, folks that are going to go into, you know, be the next generation of restaurant managers, hotel managers, even chefs, and how are, or is, I guess, first of all, is the UW-Stout, is the School of Hospitality trying to turn towards the direction of using more local ingredients, and how are you responding to what seems like a culture shift?
Sure. Thank you, Rich, first for allowing me on air.
My pleasure.
Got to say, we have a number of projects that are on staff here at UW-Stout, and that starts with first and foremost, we're trying to bring it into the classroom and understand really the sociocultural dimension of food, and see that when we look globally, we see core ingredients from all over the world. You know, one ingredient can really take you from Mexican cuisine to Lebanese cuisine. But then how do we also define what our Midwestern food is after we've begun to understand the history of our food? Once we understand that global influence, then you can actually begin to look at how our food system here is influenced by that. You know, what may seem as Midwestern food may actually be something more along the lines of European food. Mm. And so we talk about the three I's of food, representing indigenous food culture, our immigrant food culture, and then also further on to our industrialized food culture. And we want to recognize all three of those as part of our local Midwestern food culture as well.
And the Midwestern food culture, I hate to bring this up right away, but
sure.
I think of the hot dish. I think of casserole. I mean, I know that's ridiculous, but when I travel outside of the Midwest, people in this, you know, like in the South or other parts of the U.S., they think that all we do is eat, you know, tasteless, bland food. So is there any truth to that, first of all? I mean, and, you know, I know that Scandinavian cooking has a lot of roots here and et cetera, but what is that a result of, you know, this conception, this preconception of what we eat as Midwesterners?
Right, exactly, yeah, and that's something that we tackle in the class. It's one of my favorite things to ask, not only when I'm traveling, but then also in class. What is Midwestern food? And really try to define it in a concise sentence. And yeah, I don't think we've ever been able to really do that very well. And you know, maybe Amy or Nathan could chime in and give their own definition as well, too. But I think that, you know, we have to, first of all, recognize the indigenous culture that was here long before, the things like the Manoman rice that are probably on menus along the way in, you know, eastern Minnesota and western Wisconsin here. But then also how our immigrant culture, like you mentioned it, Scandinavian, a lot of German ancestry, if you look at northeastern Wisconsin, how that's played a role. And then, of course, you know, Chicago was really a hub for industrialized food in the 20s, 30s, and 40s after wartime, and how that impact has created this large industrial chain at risk of talking about one of those large companies again. You know, it's definitely had an impact as well on our food system as well. And I think that's where that kind of meat and potatoes image comes from during that time period as well.
And I want to go to the chefs here in the room too, in the studio. Nathan Berg, what is Midwestern food? How do you define Midwestern taste?
Well, I think he's got a good start of where you look. That's been my kind of amateur interest for the good last 15 years, was studying the food culture of the indigenous people around here, because it became apparent to me that the, you know, a culinary identity of an area, not just ours, but of anywhere, is going to, you're going to have to look back on what was there already. And so that's, but there's not a lot of information out there, not readily available. So you really have to dig deep, and you know, indigenous culture isn't in the forefront of some of our daily lives or our culture as much as it should be, in my opinion. But it's so it's hard to get some of this information. So you know, that's definitely a good place to look. But yeah, and then also, like he spoke of, the you know, the impact that we've had from the immigrants in this area, and it has been a lot of Scandinavian and German people and all that. And obviously, you know, there's like a dairy thing that happened here at some point.
Kind of a thing. Yeah.
And, but you know, also just, I was thinking of that, you know, with the immigrant culture, I was thinking of that when you were talking about how there's this idea that it's like kind of boring, plain food or whatever.
Sure.
But then I'm thinking of like sauerkraut and Limburger cheese and all these things. They are like so far from plain that, so we've got our things, but that's the direction to go. That's the way I've been looking as well, is trying to, I don't think we're there. I don't know that you have to define Midwestern, upper, I think of it as upper Midwestern food, because there's a distinct difference region than the southern parts in the Midwest. But yeah, to me, it means, you know, first and foremost, using those things that are exclusive to here. The wild rice he spoke of, maple syrup, the freshwater fishes that are around here, cranberries, the different items that you can forage out in the fields that are only from here. And to me, that's a good start.
Chef Ho, the preconceived notion, of course, is that, you know, we like gravy based food or whatever, boring food. So you kind of made a gesture when Nathan was talking about kind of redefining that or defining what it is. It's still a work in progress. It always will be. How do you want to change, or are you trying to make an actual concerted effort to change people's perceptions about what we eat in the upper Midwest?
Boy.
Is that your job?
yeah. I mean, I think we're still inventing it, personally.
Mm-hmm.
I also think we can't ignore that we have many other cultures living with us now.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the Mexican immigrants that live in my hometown and all over the area, the Somalis, the Hmong is a huge community here. Their influence is all over. I mean, we can't, many of the Hmong farmers that we work with, you know, they have their own approach to what their food is and how they relate to it. We cannot ignore that their presence is here, and we have to
work with them and use their influence in a positive way. And I mean, we try to do the best we can too to work with them and use their techniques for some. Their approach is totally different for some of this stuff. I mean, people ask us for house-made hot sauce, you know. So you can talk about how people in the Midwest don't want spicy food, but I think you can't ignore that there are, you know, plenty of us who enjoy that kind of experience now too, which possibly did not happen in the past. So I think it's changing without us doing anything. I think we are still trying to direct it in a place where it honors the local food in the best way.
When we come back, we'll talk more about local food. We've got wide open phone lines, 1-800-228-5615. If you want to jump into this conversation about local food, tell us about your region, what options there are. Tell us whether or not you grew up on a farm and you ate local food your whole life and you think this whole topic is just a bunch of silliness, kind of reverting to the old way. 1-800-228-5615. I'm joined by Matthew Giguere of the UW Stout School of Hospitality Leadership, Nathan Berg of the Lakely Restaurant, Amy Huo of the Informalist, and Arwin Rasmussen, publisher of Farm Fresh Atlas. We'll be right back.
Meetings of the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System and its committees that relate to this broadcast station are generally open to the public. Certain meetings or portions of meetings may be closed in order to address confidential information or proprietary matters. More information about specific meeting dates, times, and locations is available on the WPR website at WPR.org. Support for WPR comes from the Woodland Indian Art Show and Market, with an art competition, art classes, and native entertainment, June 30th through July 2nd at the Radisson Hotel in Green Bay. WoodlandIndianArt.com. Support also comes from De Novo Med Spa in Eau Claire, offering aesthetic treatments and preventative skin care with personalized service to address every chapter of life. More details are at denovomedspa.com.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. We're having a great discussion about local food in the Chippewa Valley and western Wisconsin as a whole. If you've got a favorite restaurant that is using local ingredients, if you are have been using local ingredients, say, from your garden for most of your life, let us know. That's local food. That's about as local as you can get. 1-800-228-5615. On the phone with us is Matthew Giguere. He's a professor in the UW Stout School of Hospitality Leadership. Arwin Rasmussen is publisher of the Farm Fresh Atlas and Second Opinion magazines. She's got many more. Amy Huo is the executive chef at The Informalist. You should check it out. Nathan Berg is the head chef at The Lakely. You should check it out. I've eaten at both restaurants, and they're fantastic. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call. I wanted to talk about accessibility very quickly here, and I'll start with you, Matthew Giguere. This is a great, I think it, you know, it's people are excited about this trend of people turning more to where their food comes from, being more conscientious about how it's produced and the care that goes into it, the taste. But I'm wondering, I live in the city of Eau Claire. I live in a neighborhood that is a food desert, definitely, by any definition. So a lot of people who might not have transportation, ready access to their own vehicles, they're filling up grocery carts at the local convenience store, and it kind of breaks my heart when I see that because there are such great options. I'm wondering, this local food stuff tends to cost more, so is it exclusive? Is it only for people that are the haves, the privileged, in your opinion? Do you think there's an issue there?
Sure, and I think it's a moment where we need to step back and kind of educate as well to some of the consumerism culture that we have.
Okay.
You know, I think that if there was a way, I always talk about if there's a way that we could boil down the nutrient density of our local foods and the amount of money that you're paying for them, and somehow find an equation that you can see the value that you're getting for, you know, the nutrient density of something that is local, I think you'd be coming out ahead. I think when you're getting these wholesome foods, especially from local areas and local farmers, you're able to eat a bit less and still have the same kind of nutrient density that you would if you're getting these more industrialized foods. I think there's some research out there, and we're going to continue to look at that issue of food accessibility as well, too, in the Menominee area. Because of the definition of food desert, right? It's, either in an urban setting 1 mile or in a rural setting 10 miles from a, quote, large supermarket store is what the USDA defines it as. And that in itself kind of, skews. And I think in the latest round of the food desert log, I think they've recognized that it's hard sometimes to look beyond that large supermarket store in order to get definition, in order to get a large blueprint of the nation. But if we look at Menominee alone, we have a fantastic market co-op, a farmer's market, and, of course, we're surrounded by a number of local farmers in the western part of the state here. I think there's really an opportunity for individuals to have this kind of utopia of local food because we live right amongst the agriculture that we can eat.
Sure. Arwin Rasmussen, I wanted to go to you because in this area that I live in, the food desert, it is within walking distance of one of the best farmers markets I've ever seen, the one downtown Phoenix Park. There are a lot of options there. So we're talking about specifically people going to restaurants and experiencing mm-hmm. the local foods that way. But is there a way to educate people that, they don't have to go to the gas station to pick up their foods? They can get a lot of good stuff down the street for pretty reasonable prices.
Right.
And whose job is it to teach them that? Or to, and this right. is all sounding very condescending.
No.
Like they need to be taught even. So there's a whole bunch of questions there.
But I think that is the role of certainly the two publications I have. We get them out in as many places as possible so people can pick them up and read about, nutrients lost when you truck something across the country versus, something that's picked literally that morning and hauled to the farmer's market mm-hmm. and what that can do for aging and diseases and just general health. If we can, educate them through the TV shows like this, obviously on the radio, and print publications, I think it's just a hammering. It's like people, they want what's convenient. And sometimes that's what you said, the gas station,
yeah,
all that stuff's really cheap.
It is.
It's super cheap, and the farmer's market's just down the road, but they don't make that leap that they could be healthier. So yeah, it's a repetitive thing. It's something you have to say over and over and over again until those of us who already know it are like, come on, you should already know this, but they don't. That's not how it works.
It's a tough thing to overcome when you could pick up a meal from wherever that is cheaper than what you could make it at home, even though it would be better, it would be tastier.
Right.
There are definitely situations like that. I wanted to go to Nathan and Chef Ho. Nathan, I mean, the restaurants that both of you are operating, speaking in terms of other cities like Chicago or New York, it's definitely reasonable, but it costs more to eat a meal at the Lakely than it does to go and pick up something from wherever. So do you think that there's an exclusivity to this in terms of going to restaurants that serve these ingredients, or is that a misconception?
I won't call it a full misconception, but it's just a matter of how you approach the idea. The easiest way for me to look at it is that there's no single restaurant that is for everyone. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, anybody that goes to your local fast food burger place, well, there's some people that don't want a fast food burger, and so they need a different place. So,
yeah.
Just the idea that some places are more expensive and others aren't, there's just different kinds of people that want different things. And so
mm-hmm.
I don't look at it from that perspective as much, but I would like to go back to kind of what you were all talking about just a moment ago about the idea that just this food is more expensive and that it becomes exclusive for a certain kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
It can be more expensive. That's but that's almost a backwards way of looking at it because, industrialists have made it so cheap
mm-hmm.
to get all of the other food that now it's all of a sudden we're stuck with the burden of cooking real food
sure.
and being told that it's too expensive.
Interesting.
Also,
true.
Many of the costs of those food are just hidden from us. They show up in tax subsidies for these giant farms that do certain things, you know, in gas subsidies for foods that are trucked all over the place. I mean, so these the food system that runs all this super inexpensive food does have hidden costs that the consumer themselves might not be paying directly, but that they'll be seeing elsewhere. And then the other thing that I was going to say when it comes to the education of people eating these kind of foods or trying to get people to understand that they're better and I was thinking of it before, but then when you were talking about how you kind of have to repeat it over and over and over, and I think to me that's why local food is so great, is that the easiest way to teach people is have them taste it. It really has to start with pleasure, because when people understand that there's just some like immense pleasure and to be had from this great food, then you don't have to discuss it philosophically necessarily. You can just get it in a heartbeat, you know?
Right. Amy Hoare, did you want to...
I want to touch on just for 2 seconds the importance of supporting the community as a business that, you know, pays its employees well and pays its cooks well and offers benefits. And, you know, we don't require our cooks to do 12-hour days like a lot of places, a lot of restaurants do. We are trying to be a place that, you know, supports our employees as much as they are going to support the community. So they care, and they, in turn, you know, we are paying for them to care and paying for them to work at a place that cares about its community.
Right.
And that has, you know, a lot more benefits, as in they spend their money that they work for us in the community. So it's not just that the food is more expensive, just the food. It's that we are putting a lot more effort into many other places to support that kind of system.
It's a bigger thing than just an
apple that's in your hand. It is how it got there, where it came from, and all that other stuff.
Excellent. And Matthew Jaguar, I'm going to give you the last word here. We've only got 30 seconds, but I'm wondering how much of this is generational. I mean, do you think that people that are younger in general are more open to this idea, and you'll have the last word.
Sure, I think so. You know, that's something we impress upon our students at UW Stout with our slow food organization. And, you know, Chef Mason talked about pleasure, and that's really how we teach it, is through the pleasure of food with responsibility, sustainability, and harmony with nature. You know, I think naturally Wisconsin food is local food. I have those romantic images of my grandma slicing cabbage for sauerkraut, like we talked about before.
Sure.
And it's really just reemerging back to that message of local food. And I think that's what the Wisconsin system is doing by creating this trend. And I think, you know, Amy, Arlen, and Nathan are all great advocates. And I hope that we're sending out a number of advocates out of our university as well to continue that message of good, clean, and fair food and making that accessible for all the people here in the western state of Wisconsin.
All right. With that, thank you to all of my guests. Thanks for the folks who called in and tried to call in. I understand we were having some issues with the phone call-in system, but I appreciate it. Matthew Jaguar is a professor at UW Stout's School of Hospitality and Leadership. Nathan Berg is head chef at the Lakely in the Oxbow. Check it out. Amy Huo is executive chef at the Informalist in the Lismore. Check it out. Arwen Rasmussen is publisher of the Farm Fresh Atlas. Check it out. And there are a lot of options for local foods. Don't just rely on a restaurant. Check out your farmers markets. There's a lot of great things happening. We'll chat again next Monday morning.